Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to a new episode on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Géraldine Gudefin. Today, I'm thrilled to host historian Sarah Kramzy, who is a professor of Central European Studies and Jewish Studies at Leiden University in the Netherlands. Sarah, welcome.
Thank you.
In today's episode, we will talk about Sarah's recent monograph entitled Uprooting the Diaspora, Jewish Belonging and the Ethnic Revolution in Poland and Czechoslovakia, 1936 to 1946, which was published by the Modern Jewish Experience series at Indiana University Press in 2023. Sarah, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So first, I want to hear from you about your intellectual trajectory and how you came to the book. What led you to this particular book manuscript?
Yeah, so it really started when I was an undergrad at the College of William and Mary in Virginia, and I was studying both history and religious studies. And I had a really excellent supervisor, Laurie Koloski, who in fact I dedicate the book to. And she started teaching me in my freshman year in a history seminar called Stories About Communism, where we tried to untangle this concept of Eastern Europe and think about it more from the lens of culture and literature and ideas and people and humanity. And really, I can see the evidence of those very, very early classes in this book. These questions that I started to ask about this region, and I understand Central and Eastern Europe more broadly to lay between Salzburg, Sarajevo, and St. Petersburg. So that's the part of the world that I'm talking about. The book specifically looks at Poland and Czechoslovakia, but I think I have things to say about the region more generally. But I continued to have these questions about this region that I started having as an undergrad. And this led me to learn languages, to spend lots of time in this area, and to eventually get into archives. And by the time I started working on my PhD at UC Berkeley, I had a team of advisors who were very supportive of this one fundamental question that I had, which is basically how did the possibilities for Jewish belonging in Central and Eastern Europe change and diminish over time? And to what extent did that dovetail with the event that comes to be known as the Holocaust? And to what extent was it dovetailing with other larger processes as well? So that's kind of the trajectory.
So kind of delving more into the book itself based on this short introduction that you gave us, I wonder why you chose specifically to look at Poland and Czechoslovakia. What are those places within this broader region matter to you? What did you think they deserve to have this, you know, closed examination of what happened to Jews during that decade that you studied in the book?
Right. Well, of course, a lot of historical research hinges on the languages that we have access to. And I come to this region and to this book first and foremost as someone who studied Slavic languages. So these were languages that I had capacities in. These are archives that I knew really well. These are places that I knew well, and they were places that I wanted to spend a lot of time in. So of course, that makes a big difference when you figure out like what stories you're going to be able to tell because of the documents. But beyond that, you know, a lot of this book happened because I didn't get the dissertation research grant that I wanted to get. And I was forced to go first to the American Jewish Archive in Cincinnati, Ohio, which is an amazing archive. It's an amazing place to study. They have the entire original collection of something called the World Jewish Congress. And when I started my research for the dissertation first in America, because I didn't have the scholarship or fellowship that I wanted to have to go and spend time abroad. It was there that I began to realize that the Czech and the Polish parts of the World Jewish Congress had a lot of stories to tell me, had a lot of interesting documents. And I also liked the idea that even though, you know, we talk about Central European Jews or Central and East Europe or East Europe, we use all these kind of regional identifications. I liked being able to talk about Poland and Czechoslovakia in comparison, especially because from the standpoint of the 1920s and the 1930s, they seem to represent very different milieus for people who identify as Jews or follow a Jewish way of life. And one of the things that I was then able to do was to talk about how the questions that I was trying to ask sometimes had transnational answers, sometimes had regional answers, and sometimes had much more specific national or local answers. So that's kind of how I came to Czechoslovakia and Poland. A lot of it had to do with language and familiarity with archives and networks, but also it had to do with where the sources were taking me. And it became very clear to me at a certain point that given my Polish and language, Polish and Czech language capabilities alongside my other Jewish languages, because of course, Czech and Polish are Jewish languages, just like Hebrew and Yiddish are Jewish languages, that I was, let's say, primed to tell this particular story.
So I want to return to the question of sources and archives shortly, but I think for the sake of understanding the scope of the book, I would love to hear from you first about the main claims that you're making in the book. What are you arguing? What are the main kind of takeaway points? And it's so hard to summarize, you know, such a dense book. But for those who want to have a preview of the book, what would you say are like the major books, the major claims of the book, and what you see as your main contributions to the different literatures that you are in conversation with through this book?
Yeah, of course. So one of the things I try to understand in this book is something called the ethnic revolution. And the ethnic revolution, more broadly, is the process by which the region that we identify as Central and Eastern Europe shifted from being based on heterogeneous polities to being transformed into presumably mono-ethnic nation states. And I'm very interested in how millions of people were moved around in the 1940s, late 1930s and the early 1940s, and to what extent we can understand how this moving around, the acceptance of population transfers as a viable tool that states could use by the international community, how the moving around and reorganization of ethnicities in Central and Eastern Europe led to the simultaneous embrace of Palestine as an ethno-territory for Jews from the region that had survived the Second World War and the Holocaust. So the book speaks to people that are interested in broader questions of Jewish belonging. Who belongs to the Jewish people and where do the Jewish people belong? The book also speaks to people that are interested in international norms and specifically how the idea of population transfers from the 1930s onwards gains a particular acceptance as a viable tool that states and great powers can use to organize populations. And finally, it also speaks to what we think we know about Zionism and how Zionism as a movement and an ideology changes quite a bit from the 1930s to the 1940s. And my main goal was to really use this history of a Jewish minority in the region to illuminate broader stories and how we understand what happens in the 1940s and how this ethnic revolution still really configures the way that we see the world, that we organize humanity, and that we continue to think about all different types of futures.
So I want to hear more about the Zionism piece of it, because you, I think, coined this term in the book of empirical Zionism, and it's connected to what you just described about the concept of an ethnic revolution. So could you tell us more a little bit about this empirical Zionism and what it allows us to see about the history of Zionism and Palestine and Israel that we might not necessarily see from today's standpoint?
Of course, empirical Zionism is this idea that the reduction of Jewish population in Europe because of the Holocaust, because of a genocide, and because of the Second World War, made the possibility for Jewish settlement in Palestine and the possibility for a Jewish state that later came to be known as Israel, much more possible in people's minds. And if we think back to the 1930s, even the most radical, quote unquote, Zionists, if we take someone like Vladimir Jabotinsky, who my colleague Brian Horowitz has written so compellingly about, even when cornered by the Warsaw Physicians Union in 1936, Jabotinsky said that even if he's able to settle as many Jews as he would like each year in Palestine, which the land would only be able to support upwards of around 200,000 people a year, even if he could settle as many Jews as he could possibly settle in Palestine, within 10 years, there would still be about 2.7 million Jews living in Poland. Even the most radical plans that Zionists had in the 1930s did not negate any diaspora, even if they were speaking in terms of saying that the diaspora is bad and we need to get rid of it. One of the things that you see during the war, as awareness of the final solution becomes more apparent, is that people begin to think, okay, look, we have a reduction of the number of Jews that are alive in Europe. That number is looking more and more like it could be feasible to transport that number to Palestine. And perhaps we should have an entity like the United Nations or the United Nations Relief and Rehabilitation Administration move Jews away from their homelands and towards this presumed homeland as part of broader repatriation efforts that will have to happen after the war. So by empirical Zionism, I'm talking about an adoption of a policy by both people who follow a Jewish way of life and people who don't follow a Jewish way of life. And one of the most steadfast proponents of empirical Zionism is Edvard Beneš, the president of the Czech government in exile, and then the president of Czechoslovakia once again when Czechoslovakia is reconstituted after the Second World War. And he endorses empirical Zionism, not because he necessarily wants Czechoslovak Jews to move away from Czechoslovakia. No, he wants to make sure that ethnic Germans, presumed ethnic Germans, are going to be forcibly expelled from Czechoslovakia. And by advocating for the movement of Jews to a Jewish polity somewhere else, he's able to buttress his claims to move Germans to a German polity somewhere else. So it's a way of seeing the world in very, very stark, presumably ethnic terms. And what I find so interesting is how quickly this idea of an empirical Zionism becomes acceptable to large numbers of people within the exiled, allied community, and then within post-war transnational and international institutions.
What you just pointed to about the entanglement of the German question, you know, in quotation marks, on the Jewish question, I think was one of the most fascinating aspects of the books. And it really, I think, brought attention to the ways in which we can't really understand the, you know, social legal situation of the Jewish minority in that region if we don't understand the broader context of how other minorities are treated. And I think the book does it quite well to show that we can't really treat the Jewish minority without taking into account what is going on with other minority groups. So I wonder if you want to say a little more about this, but I definitely thought that this was a very important point to make.
Thank you. Yeah, this actually infuses the way that I teach my courses on Jewish history. And as my students, I hope, would be able to tell you, according to me, it's impossible to write a history of people who follow a Jewish way of life without also writing a history of the people that they interact with who aren't following a Jewish way of life. And in fact, it's in this collision, which is sometimes peaceful, which is to a lesser extent unpeaceful, but can be quite explosive at very, very specific points on the historical chronology, that I really think we're able to crystallize the best types of Jewish history. I reference this a bit in chapter one, but I've done some other research on the Ukrainian minority in interwar Poland. The largest minority in interwar Poland were Ukrainians. There were 5 million ethnic Ukrainians. This is compared to around 3.3 million people who identified as being Jewish, either ethnically or by language, on the 1931 Polish census. But it strikes me that, you know, often historians of Jews in this region, they come to those stories from a point of the Jewish experience with Hebrew, with potentially Yiddish, and then learning other languages, potentially, of the people that were around them. I, in fact, came to this story from a very different place. I was first a student of Czech and Polish, and then later moved on to learn German and Hebrew and Yiddish. And I think that this inversion, to a certain extent, of my linguistic capabilities helped me tell a different story. I make a point in the introduction that I have many colleagues who have quite recently, in fact, written on the World Jewish Congress, which is an institution that I cover quite a bit in this book. It's one of the places that I draw from for the milieu that I'm trying to create. Essentially, I see this book as the biography of a conversation that's happening within a very, very typical, very specific milieu. If we're going to go off Marcy Shore's wonderful statement in Caviar and Ashes that she was interested in writing a biography of milieu, I'm interested in a biography of a conversation. But I see the people that are joining that conversation as both coming from a place where they feel connected to the Jewish people on a cultural or an ethnic level or a religious level, and then other people who aren't necessarily connected to the Jewish people in that way. So something that I've tried to do in most of my work and in my teaching is to really align what is happening to people following a Jewish way of life with people who aren't necessarily following a Jewish way of life, and see what we can learn then from that interaction.
So tell us a bit more, because you mentioned some of them. You mentioned the World Jewish Congress. So were the different protagonists in the story. Can you tell us a little bit more about the World Jewish Congress for listeners who might not be familiar with those institutions? And were the other, because I think one of the strengths of the book is this, the multiplicity of actors were engaged in that conversation were coming, in fact, from different milieus. So were the main protagonists in the story? And to go back to the conversation about sources and archives, how did you decide to include them in the book? And how did you find all the information that you needed to write, you know, this biography of a conversation as you framed it?
Yeah, of course, I'd be happy to. So, the World Jewish Congress is an organization that was founded in the 1930s. It had its first meeting in Geneva in 1936. And in fact, chapter one of the book opens with this first meeting where a group of Polish Jews had come to this meeting and they give a statement about the unity of the Polish Jewish collective that has come to this conference. And this is very surprising for anyone who knows anything about how diverse and complicated internal dynamics within the Polish Jewish community are. But this represents this huge coup at this first official meeting of the World Jewish Congress. The World Jewish Congress is an organization that's founded to protect the right of Jews to live wherever they like. This does not mean that people that are in the World Jewish Congress are not also endorsing Zionist parties or Zionist programs. In fact, it's quite possible to belong to the World Zionist Organization and belong to the World Jewish Congress. This is not something that is seen as being problematic for a lot of the people that are making this decision. But the basic premise is to say that Jews are rooted in the lands where they're living, and they should have a right to live there and have some measure of equality compared to other citizens. And the World Jewish Congress is it's still an active organization today, but I'd like to think in the book that you're able to see that it takes a very sharp turn, let's say, changes its broader connection to the diaspora throughout the 1940s to a drastic extent. So I use the World Jewish Congress, which is operating basically as a non-state actor, as an international organization that for the most part is in exile by the late 1930s, as many of the leadership members of the World Jewish Congress, like Nahum Goldman, like Ari Tartakover, like A.L. Kubovitsky, who becomes Ari Kubovy, these are people who have left their homes within Europe. Or elsewhere, and they're living for the most part in places like New York City. They're traveling to South America, they're traveling to Canada, they're traveling throughout the US, they're traveling to DC, they're traveling to London to meet with the World Jewish Congress operatives that are there. They're sending telegrams to the World Jewish Congress office in Switzerland, where Gerhard Rigner is working. And this, of course, is where we get the infamous Rigner telegram, which is one of the first instances where we can point to say, look, we have evidence here of systematic mass murder of the Jewish people within Europe that's being passed around. So I look at the World Jewish Congress and the conversations they're having amongst themselves, and then the conversations that they're having with other people, and they're mainly interfacing with the Allied powers. They're trying to get as many meetings with Sumner Wells, the Secretary of State of the U.S., as they can, through Stephen Wise, one of the leaders of the organization. Every once in a while, they're able to get an audience with Franklin Delano Roosevelt, the U.S. president. So they're really having very, very high-profile meetings. They're also meeting with the Allied powers in terms of the Czech government in exile, the Polish government in exile, and other governments in exile that are, for the most part, mainly operating out of the United Kingdom after the fall of France. And then, as the war progresses, they start having conversations with the United Nations more generally. And then, this part of the United Nations that comes into creation in the early 1940s, called the United Nations Relief and Rehabilitation Administration, which is supposed to basically go into post-war Europe and make plans and try to figure out how to clean up the war and how to get people home after they've been deported and sent elsewhere. So I really identify about 12 people within the World Jewish Congress, within the Polish government in exile, within the Czech government in exile, in the Soviet Union, so different Czechs and Polish citizens that are in the Soviet Union as well, and then just like allied powers more broadly, and really try to follow this group of people and try to understand a little bit how their ideas about where Jews belong and how those ideas change across the 1940s dovetail with other ideas about the viability of population transfers, should there be a Jewish homeland on the eastern edge of the Mediterranean, et cetera, et cetera.
So let's talk a bit more about this convergence that you're talking about in the book, which is people, as you describe, from very different milieus, doing different things, thinking about Jewish belonging in different terms, coming to this kind of convergence about where Jews should live in, in the post-war period. So what are the main factors that you've identified as contributing to this convergence of ideas between these very different individuals and institutions?
Sure. So I really see Edvard Beneš, the Czech president in exile, as being a really important, let's say, pathbreaker in terms of this idea of population transfers. And here I build on the work of my colleagues like Matthew Frank and Chad Bryant, who write about Beneš during his exile, his second exile, by the way, because of course he's in exile during the First World War as well, before the state of Czechoslovakia comes into existence, and tries to understand a little bit more about how he understood what post-war Central Europe and by default Czechoslovakia would look like. And Beneš decides very, very early on in the 1940s that a post-war Czechoslovakia will not have any ethnic Germans in it. And he, of course, is thinking about the Sudeten Germans and this irredentist movement that rose throughout the 1930s, which arguably led in part to the eventual Munich Agreement in 1938, which dismembered the state of Czechoslovakia and forced Beneš's hand, where he decided that he, rather than fight against the Nazis, he was going to leave his position as president and go become like a civilian again. So when Beneš starts to talk very vividly about Jews moving away from Central and Eastern Europe to a presumably Jewish polity, he doesn't really outline exactly what that's going to look like, but he definitely thinks it's going to be in Palestine, and he's talking about Mandate Palestine at this point. The World Jewish Congress starts to get really, really scared, because here they're seeing a very, very strange conversation coming from the mouth of someone who ostensibly hailed from the most, quote unquote, liberal state in Central or East European Europe in the interwar period. Now, we can, of course, problematize to what extent Czechoslovakia was really, really that liberal, and to what extent Beneš had these ideas about exactly what the ethnic makeup of his state should have been beforehand. But for the sake of argument, we'll just state that the World Jewish Congress starts to get very, very scared about what Beneš is saying and starts having lots of conversations with him to be like, you have to protect the right of Czechoslovak Jews to stay in Czechoslovakia. They need to have the right to have some kind of collective option in Czechoslovak law. They should be able to go to courts in their own language. They should be able to assemble as Jews, as like a national group, not just a religious group. And what's really fascinating is to see how these ideas that Beneš is espousing, that Jews should be moved from Central and Eastern Europe to Palestine, how these ideas, they very, very quickly go from being radical and or unsavory to being, this might be a good solution for the post-war period. And now all of these conversations, of course, are happening in exile. So they're getting different types of intelligence about what's happening to Jewish populations, how the Holocaust is progressing, how other campaigns of population transfers are progressing, how the broader war effort is progressing. And by the end of 1944, when the World Jewish Congress convenes something called the War Emergency Conference in Atlantic City, there's a very, very clear statement being issued from the group, which is that post-war Jewish future is not in the diaspora, that we should really be pushing our efforts towards a post-war Jewish life in a Jewish homeland, in a Jewish state, and that state should only be in Palestine. And so what I find so interesting is to kind of, I was really able to see in the archives of the World Jewish Congress this tension in the early 1940s with Beneš, and then this change by 1944. So much so that they start to have very intimate conversations with Benesch, basically asking him to lobby on behalf of the World Jewish Congress and other Zionist organizations to lobby towards the world, to the Allied powers, for the creation of some kind of Jewish collective entity in Palestine, and really pushing for increased Jewish emigration. And the World Jewish Congress becomes a big advocate of transferring this idea of empirical Zionism to the United Nations Relief and Rehabilitation Administration to say, look, the United Nations shouldn't only recognize people that have been persecuted as Jews as Jews. They should also give those people the option to be repatriated, not only to their previous homes, but in fact to a new Jewish homeland in Palestine. And you see this very clearly in the writings of Ari Tartakover and Zarah Kfar Havtig in 1943 and 1944.
So what about the Allied powers? How did they come to the conclusion that it was a natural solution for Jews to have their homeland in Palestine after the war?
Right. That's a great question. So how do conversations that happen in these exiled communities, and then of course are confirmed in what we might call like exclusively Jewish conversations, how does that move forward more broadly? Of course, Benesch, Edvard Benesch, continues to be a very important figure because he gets endorsement from Roosevelt, Stalin, and Churchill that they are going to sign off on population transfers, specifically regarding to the ethnic Germans in Czechoslovakia and elsewhere after the war. So he becomes a really important figure pushing this forward. But of course, what is happening on the ground? And that's what I really try to unpack in the last chapter of Uprooting the Diaspora, which tries to look at the Bricha, or the semi-legal movement of European Jews away from Europe after the Second World War and the Holocaust, through a new lens. And that's the lens of border politics. That's the lens of negotiations between transnational organizations like the UNRWA and individual governments and individual actors on the ground, both at the border, specifically the border between Poland and Czechoslovakia, which of course is becoming a new border as Poland itself moves to the West. So I really try to show how ideas that are captured in this shift in international norms towards the endorsing of population transfers, specifically population transfers that are directed within this region. And of course, those of us that know about the global history of post-World War II know that population transfers start to happen in many places throughout the world. But within this particular region, I zoom in to try to show what's happening at a local level on the border, in rooms within the different ministers of defense and social welfare and citizenship within Poland, post-war Poland and Czechoslovakia. Then more broadly, what's happening at, like, for example, the three UNRWA meetings that take place in the year 1946. And then much more broadly, how Allied leaders are beginning to think a little bit about the way that Jews are moving away from places like post-war Poland, especially more than 150,000 Jews who returned from the Soviet Union, where they have survived the war and the Holocaust, specifically because they have fled there or they have been deported within to the Soviet Union, to what extent they should be allowed to pool in displaced persons camps, like the displaced persons camps in occupied Germany or in occupied Austria, and how Czechoslovakia becomes this natural geographical conduit. How do the borders stay open? And what we see is that through 1946, there's nothing particularly inevitable about this idea that the borders are going to stay open and that tens of thousands to upwards of hundreds of thousands people designated as Jews are going to be able to even make it into these camps. And the majority of the people that end up in the displaced persons camps in occupied Germany and occupied Austria do not end up going to Palestine, later the state of Israel. But let's say there's a sizable number from this population that is able to help balance some of the demographics within Israel-Palestine in 1947 and 1948, and therefore play an important role in the wars that ensue after the declaration of independence of the state of Israel in the spring of 1948. So to answer your question very briefly, it translates on the ground and around conference tables at international organizations and continues in conversations, but in quite an unanticipated and sporadic way. And anyone who's interested in how ideas about the diaspora shift and how people begin to have different understandings of Jewish belonging and to recognize these as questions that are contingent. And I'd like to just also say more broadly that when I think about belonging, I see all types of belonging as contingent. Just as we should question Jewish belonging, where Jews belong and who belongs to the Jewish people, that we make similar questions about, let's say, who belongs to Czechoslovakia, who belongs to the Czech Republic? What does this even mean when we're trying to tie a people to a land? These questions of territoriality, I think they're very vibrant in the Jewish narrative, but this is not an exclusively Jewish question, even though that's what I'm zooming in on in the book.
That brings me to two separate questions, actually. The first one has to do with this Jewish angle on the ethnic revolution. And by this, I mean that clearly the ethnic revolution that you talk about is one case study in a much broader phenomenon, right? We've had some instances of this happening even before World War II. And this idea that, you know, we have this particular region shifting, I mean, imperfectly, but still you have this shift from multi-religious, multi-ethnic entities to what you call like mono-ethnic states. We've seen this in other regions as well. So what is, do you see anything distinct about the Jewish story that you're telling in the book that separates it fundamentally from other similar shifts? That's the first question. And related to it is, what do you think the Jewish story allows us to see about this shift? Is there anything in this story that helps us understand something that unfolded in other times and places? So that's the first question. And the second question has to do with what you very eloquently said about belonging, which is really kind of zooming in on the post-war period, which you do in the final two chapters, chapter four and chapter five. And two aspects that are really interesting here are, first, the question of citizenship and nationality. What kind of issues did Jews wanting to go home or not wanting to go home face in respect to their nationality and citizenship? And then the question of post-war anti-Semitism and especially acts of violence against Jews. So there's a lot here to unpack, but let's start with this question of what can the Jewish story tell us about the ethnic revolution that happened in this in the second part of the 20th century?
Sure, of course. You know, it's funny. In some ways, I don't see the story that I'm telling as a Jewish story. I see this as a story rooted in Central and Eastern Europe. And that I'm very interested in the ascent and the agreement to the ascent of an ethnic / mono-ethnic nation state. And if we just think about nationalism, right, and what's the best laboratory to study nationalism, it strikes me, and perhaps this is because I'm a bit biased, that the lands of the former Habsburg Empire are incredible lands to study how nationalism develops as a political movement, how different nationalists have different ideas about the political autonomy of the nation and what form that political autonomy should take. So obviously, Central and Eastern Europe is not the only place where this is happening. But what I see is that it's happening here in this region incredibly quickly. And this is something that even shocked me as I was writing the book, to see how discussions and the momentum pushing for empirical Zionism or this population transfer that would be paid for by some other entity of the Jewish people really sped up at a certain point in time. And, you know, if we think about nationalism, as recent studies in nationalism have pushed us to think about, nationalism as very hard work, something that isn't necessarily natural, something that national activists have to be doing, that they're combating something called national indifference, that people aren't necessarily nations, but they need to be convinced that they are. What we find, and here I echo the words of John Connolly, that a lot of people were willing to do this very, very hard work, this very violent work of moving millions of people around, often very, very quickly. Over just a few months, upwards of 3 million ethnic Germans are expelled from post-war Czechoslovakia. And this completely corrupts that state's economy. This completely imperils the state's very existence and viability with this mass movement of people. And that's one of the things that I found so interesting, that by looking at the Jewish story, I was able to capture something that is very, very based in this region. So one could say somewhat universal. But by virtue of the fact that this Jewish homeland was seen as somewhere away, I was able to tap into another question that I think is really important in the teaching and writing of Jewish history, which is how do we explain the persistence of Jewish otherness throughout historical time? And it's shocking when we think that in many ways, the Holocaust hardened senses of ethnicity, that the Holocaust allowed for the creation of a legal category of who a Jew is, and that the United Nations uses this assessment in order to classify who the displaced people are according to their Jewish heritage, because they don't want those people to not get certain benefits. But by doing that, they're basically keeping Nazi-informed definitions of who a Jew is alive. And of course, we continue to see the ramifications of that in the right to the right of return, in the Israeli legal code in the 1950s, and moving forward, just this question of who is Jewish and how we begin to understand Jewishness. How does this relate to other times in Jewish history? I think that's a great question. One of the things that we see, and I'll speak to anti-Semitism as well, is that the anti-Semitism that is happening in Poland in 1946, like for instance, when the Kielce pogrom occurs, or in 1945, when there's a pogrom in Kraków, as Anna Ciopek-Garai has written so beautifully about in her first book, and circles back to it in her second book. One of the things that we see is that anti-Semitism changes drastically. When Joel Kang, who is a Polish-Jewish person, returns to Poland in 1946. He spent the war in the United Kingdom, where he's trying to get a permanent job as a journalist, and he eventually succeeds in becoming a permanent correspondent for what is then the Manchester Guardian, what is now known as just the Guardian. He starts reporting on the anti-Semitism that he's seeing in Poland in the 1940s, and he's saying, this is a lot different than the anti-Semitism that I saw in the 1930s. Something about the extreme othering and the genocide of the Jews in Poland and elsewhere in the 1940s has changed the way that anti-Semitism operates, that this is a different type of animal. And often it's really easy for us to just use this word anti-Semitism, just like it's really easy for us to just use the word Zionism and to think that there's something lasting or timeless about those ideas or about those things. And one of the things that I was able to notice in the research for this book is that when we think about Jewish otherness and we think about anti-Semitism, these are things that are changing and can take on much, much different forms. And so in this sense, you know, I'd like to think that uprooting the diaspora speaks to people who are just interested in this idea of Jews as citizens. Right. And you can look at the history of modern Europe. And in particular, I'm thinking of Ronald Schechter's excellent book, Obstinate Hebrews, where he basically says, look, here we have the Jew becoming this really important figure for the French revolutionaries, for Napoleon. And he's using the lens of the Jew and the Jewish experience to better understand the Enlightenment, the French Revolution, the Napoleonic part of that revolution, and then like what comes afterwards. And my hope is that what I've done here in uprooting the diaspora can, you know, link, let's say, Jewish stories to broader stories that are happening in the 1940s. And this, of course, is a time when we like to think that Jewish stories and non-Jewish stories really diverge. And of course, they diverge. The genocide of the Jews is exceptional. It's exceptional on three registers, and I'm happy to talk about that in another podcast. But what we see here is how the Jewish story is intertwined with all of these other stories. And yet, there's this distinction of this Jewish homeland being somewhere else, and what that means for local populations that are living there in Mandate Palestine at the time, and what that means for the crumbling of British colonial authority and a broader decolonization efforts throughout the world.
Thank you so much, Sarah. There's much more to unpack and say about the book, but I think I'll just invite the readers to pick it up at the library and read those wonderful chapters. But before finishing, we typically ask the guest to tell us about their current, ongoing, and future research projects. And I wanted to point out to readers that you recently published an article in International Migration Review titled Uprooted Families. I like the connection between the two titles, right? Uprooting the Diaspora and Uprooting Families, Caretaking, Belonging, and Inheritance During and After Displacement. So if you have a few seconds to talk about this current project, I would love to hear about it. And I also wanted, as a kind of a segue into this final question, to read a short paragraph from your book, Uprooting the Diaspora, that really struck me and gave me a lot of food for thought, which is in the final chapter where you talk about returning Polish Jews who attempted to come back from Soviet Central Asia. And you write in the book, roughly a quarter of the Polish Jews who returned to Poland in 1946 from the USSR were under the age of 7, and 1/8 were under the age of 2. Really staggering numbers. The presence of so many young people, toddlers and babies, exerted demands on their caregivers and should make us reconsider how we tell their wartime and post-war stories. Their lives in Soviet exile across 7 wartime and post-war years were dominated by the realities of family creation, including fertility, family planning, childbearing and childrearing, and populated with caregivers who helped these families grow. So beautifully stated. I mean, such an important point that really gets forgotten in the historiography. So on this note, I would love to hear from you about your interest in this particular question and how it's shaping your current research projects.
Yeah, of course. And this also gives me just a second to thank you so much for being such an astute reader of the book, asking such beautiful questions and really demonstrating to me that you've taken this offering that I've pushed out into the world and really tried to grapple with it. And I really appreciate that. It is quite hard to get people to really pay attention to what you're trying to say. And I really appreciate the expertise and also the delicacy that you've brought to this particular interview. So thank you, Geraldine. And actually, I don't really need to speak that much more about my next project because you've pinpointed it. I have shifted from diplomats to diapers, and I am writing a history of care, specifically care of very, very young children during the Holocaust. And this book project is called The Other Holocaust, Care, Children, and the Jewish Catastrophe. And one thing that I'm zooming in on is a question that appears to be timeless, which is, okay, I've just birthed this human being out of my body, and now I have to try to keep it alive and try to understand to what extent the answer to that question changes and doesn't change during extraordinary circumstances like a war, like a genocide, like when you're being deported somewhere else and you're thousands of kilometers away from your family and your care network. How do you learn how to breastfeed? How do you get an abortion if that's something that you decided that you need to get? How do you raise a child in a new environment and an environment that appears to be an environment that is quite exceptional? So this is what I'm working on. And thank you for noting this new article that just came out. That's, in fact, the introduction to a special issue of the International Migration Review that I've put together with some of my colleagues who attended a conference that I convened at Leiden University about a year ago. And we have seven different contributors who talk about care more broadly across many different periods of his historical upheaval, from my colleague Beres Ulker, who's talking about undertakers caring for Turkish migrant families in modern-day Berlin, to my colleague Adnan Makhmutovic, who is writing about children who grow up in the Bosnian diaspora in Sweden after the Yugoslav wars in the mid-1990s, to my other colleague, Melissa Walls, who does work on the long-term medical consequences of uprootedness and diaspora in Native American communities that live now in the countries that are now known as America, the United States of America, and Canada. So I've really, let's say, stopped reading diplomatic wires and conversations and started to read a bit more about how caretaking practices change. But I should note that there will be at least one character who finds themselves in this second book. I actually found one of the children of a World Jewish Congress leader who is in fact mentioned in a document that I talk about in chapter three. This is when A.L. Kubovitsky is talking about needing to talk to his son and explain to his son what the Jewish people did. Well, that son eventually grew up and is now a part of my new book project, specifically looking at how Yad Vashem came up with this category of the righteous among the nations and how we begin to memorialize care, especially care of very, very young children.
That's fascinating and such important research. Good luck with this. And before we part ways, I want to mention to the readers that the book has wonderful pictures, really gorgeous pictures. But one of them that really struck me was this picture of this two young Polish Jewish mothers holding their babies, caring for their babies. And this is, I think, kind of an entry point into the questions that you're asking in this new project. So thank you so much, Sarah. It's been such a pleasure to host you today. And thank you to our listeners for joining us today. Have a great day, everyone. Thank you so much.